The Leftovers, the officially unofficial podcast for The Leftovers on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And tonight we're talking about Season 1, Episode 9, The Garveys at Their Best. Was this The Garveys at Their Best? I think it might have been.
Like, setting the bar pretty fucking low, but yeah, it does feel
like...
But
if you take where they are now and look at where they are in this flashback, I think this might be The Garveys at Their Best.
Well, they have 50% less of their members in cults. At this point, so that's always a good point.
Still the same amount smoking, though.
It's true. Yeah. That is true.
Before we get into, like, actually talking about this episode, why don't we do a little announcement-type stuff up front?
Sure. We actually are incredibly excited that HBO social media management-type folks have asked us to participate on the official Watching the Leftovers site.
Yeah, that is super cool.
They want us to do a preview podcast, kind of talking about the, you know, some spoil, not spoilers, but some speculation and theory about what's going to happen in the finale episode, because they're taking HBO as it's wont to do. They're going to celebrate Memorial Day weekend like the rest of us and not have a new episode of The Leftovers.
Sure.
So for something a little special, they've reached out to us and asked us to record a short, like, 20-minute podcast for them, and we're super excited to do that. And if you want to help us out with some of your speculation and spoilers, it's going to be a tight, like, again, 20-minute episode.
Yeah.
Feel free to send it in to leftovers@baldmove.com, or another great place for a quick hit like that would be to put it in the facebook.com/baldmove thread for this episode, this podcast. 140 characters would be... great
say,
for
yeah.
a short take at Bald Move on Twitter. But thanks again to Tanner over at HBO for inviting us and putting it all together. It's still kind of, I don't have an official date and all that stuff. We're kind of negotiating as we go, but I feel like it's a pretty done deal that we'll be doing it for them. So
yeah, I'm super excited about that.
Me too, man.
What else
Me
do we
too.
Have?
Yeah, I got some background information for the episode. This was directed by Daniel Sackheim, who has worked on tons of stuff, including The X-Files, Law & Order, House MD, NYPD Blue. He's a currently working director on The Walking Dead and The Americans, and now The Leftovers, and is written by Kath Lingenfelter, who we earlier got to know in the Two Boats and a Helicopter episode. She was also the co-writer with Damon Lindelof with that. And like we said last time, she's been active in House MD, Caprica, worked on Sleeper Cell, Boston Public, Pushing Daisies, lots of stuff. And also, this is the first episode that went over, it got 1.85 million people watching it, which is like a tenth of a million higher than the premiere episode. So it looks like people are starting to catch up and get on the Leftovers bandwagon, the train, full steam ahead. I'm kind of excited to see what the kind of numbers they pull for the finale episode.
I'm kind of excited to hear more train analogies, honestly.
You don't hear that a lot of that time, yeah. I wonder, do you think that finale... because let's talk about what we thought about this episode. And to set up the context of, I feel like the finale is going to be something that kind of makes or breaks the series. It's already been announced that it's been renewed, so we're going to get a season two.
Sure.
But I feel, for my money, I feel like they've answered enough questions that I am going to be content and a lot more relaxed about going into season two, that, you know, this isn't going to be something that kind of jerks us around.
Sure, yeah, I don't want to do the wrap-up cast here.
No, I know, but I just wonder, do you feel that, and I'm speaking for other people, not myself, because again, I'm kind of invested, but do you feel from a majority of the fan base and people watching the show on HBO that they're kind of sitting around to see if the finale is good, if it delivers, if it gives us some solid answers, or does it ask more questions before people fully invest? Because I feel like there's a lot of people like the Andrew Greenwalds and the Bill Simmons of the world, you know, kind of tastemakers, critics, that are still holding out thinking that, you know, there's just no there, which I already think is a ridiculous proposition. What do you think?
Yeah, the there that needs to be there is the emotional impact for these characters, and I think that's been shown to us in spades. Now, there is kind of this metaphysical twist. There's a potentially metaphysical twist. There are a lot of questions that we don't have answers to, but I feel like this episode took a lot of the stuff that we had all kind of been speculating and figured out on our own and just really said, okay, those are the answers.
Yeah.
A lot of answers in this episode in particular. And I feel like if they do the same thing as far as maybe like what happened right after the disappearance, if they just kind of continue it from where they left off here, in the next episode, they'll be right on track.
I don't, from the brief previews I saw on the immediately after the episode aired on HBO, I don't get that we're going to resume. I feel like we're going to flash back to the quote-unquote present day in the Leftovers universe. That would be an interesting idea to explore early on in season two.
Sure. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Are we ready to start talking about the episode?
Yeah, I think we should, instead of talking about the exact same things we're going to talk about next week here.
So I guess we'll start from the beginning scene. That seems like a good place to start, where Kevin is going for a run. It's how we started the whole season.
Yeah.
In episode one, we're kind of going back to that. Everyone's smiling and waving. A lot of contrasts. That there's a couple of listeners that sent us an email on that we'll be talking about in the feedback section. But he's running armed. He sneaks a cigarette at the mailbox. He sees Harry Potter's Patronus with a big flaming sun between his horns.
Okay.
I gotta say for the ladies that he's totally John Hamming it up here. He's got his he's got Kevin Jr. Flopping around on his left and right thigh.
What?
You didn't. What? That's what? Hilarious because you asked most guys this episode, did you see Kevin Garney Jr.'s massive schlong flopping around in sweatpants? And I guarantee probably nine out of 10 was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
But
you asked me that during the episode. I was like, no, when was that?
No, like my girlfriend was like, oh my God, Garvey dick. And like all the women in the thread were commenting about the appearance
What happens when you wear boxers and sweatpants? It's just not containing anything.
I question whether he was wearing boxers at all. It was a flop around wild and free there.
This is how we're going to start the show. Okay,
this is exactly how we're going to start the show.
Yeah.
So I want to throw a couple things out on the table.
whoa. Before we get too into
three things in particular, it's a left, right, and center.
Okay. Yep.
Him sneaking cigarettes at the mailbox.
Yeah.
In his dream sequences, we've seen a vicious beast caged into mailboxes. What does his smoking have to do with that? Or is there a connection between him retrieving this package to his son leaving a package for Wayne? Does that somehow connect their characters? Or is this smoking as Kevin's dark side? Are we going to find out that he like chain smokes like he's on fire, like he needs a chimney when he's in his dark side mode?
That's a good question, because didn't he have a cigarette when he killed Patty?
Or
when Patty killed herself, I guess.
Yeah. Possibly.
Wasn't he out? Didn't he smoke in the woods? I think he smoked in the woods. He also bummed a cigarette off the woman that he was screwing when the whole departure thing happened.
Which could be an arguable, presage into a quote unquote dark side of him coming out.
Sure.
He's not a good guy. He's a bad guy.
Yeah, and it could be, there are a lot of cracks showing in Kevin's life here.
Well,
and I feel like the smoking is tangled up in that.
Certainly. And
it's the veneer of his perfect life. The literal cracks we see throughout this episode. And then the discussion he has with his father, I feel like smoking is an extension of that as well. Like he's hiding that from his family.
Is there any connection to Lori picking up smoking and him giving it up?
Hmm.
But then, so kind of like, is that her tapping into some kind of dark nihilistic thing? Damon Lindelof, is cigarettes shorthand for evil?
Matt, he lives in California, right? They might be.
Yeah. It's true.
I don't know. I hadn't even considered that question. Certainly, I think Lori just takes up smoking because, you know, that's what the GR do.
But Kevin also rejected it.
But symbolically.
And she was not smoking this episode, she seemed to be thinking, and there's a little, she seemed to be in denial about her being unsatisfied. Like she flat out denied it when Patty tried to you know, make common cause with. There's like, no, that's just something that you've got going on. Where Kevin seems like he's a lot more conscious of the mini cracks. We see literal cracks in his house. We see his coffee mug that is emblazoned with the fact that he's somebody's hero, cracked, leaking coffee.
Yeah.
Something to that. Mm-hmm. Did you do any research into Saint Hubertus or Hubertus?
I read the most brief synopsis possible of his story.
This is the deer symbolism with the flaming thing between its antlers is a very clear nod. In fact, if you look at the religious iconography, mm-hmm. It's eerie how much that scene is staged to look just like one of these, you know, wood carvings or stained glass windows. And the legend goes this man lost, I believe, his wife and daughter, or maybe wife and son. And he decides to just take up hunting, and he becomes this great hunter, you know, kills as many animals as he can. He takes aim at one particular deer, and he sees this blazing cross, like flaming Jesus heart cross, like you see in a lot of Catholicism. And the deer speaks to him and tells him to go see this other guy to get religious instruction, tells him, you know, hands down this thing for humane hunting, including, like, you know, you should go after the old stags and the sick, and you shouldn't shoot at female deer with babies, and something that's still, like, kind of modern, is weirdly based, a lot of our modern hunting practices are still based on these teachings, mm-hmm. Because they're common sense stuff. That, what does that mean? So obviously Kevin's got the hard on for saving the deer, and he wants to be humane. And in fact, that extends to the other animals. And, you know, there's a lot of theories here that these animals, the crazy animals, are also representative of the GR, who Kevin, when he's in his conscious state, mm-hmm. seems hell-bent to try to save and rehabilitate too.
Yeah.
What, is this just Damon being clever and mining this stuff just to mine it for people that are aware of it? Because I don't feel like that tells us anything new about Kevin's character we didn't know already.
Yeah. Well, it's also tied up in the stuff that his dad says about the deer when they're discussing it at the police station. You know, if it's unstable, we need to kill it, versus Kevin wanting to tranquilize it and release it into the woods. And this deer has kind of been hounding him after the fact,
sure. Right?
After the departure. It might be as simple to say, like, this is a sign that there are a lot of signs in this episode, potentially, that something is coming. It might be as simple to just say, this is a sign that Kevin is seeing that he's not acknowledging at the time, but now with potential voices and him going quote unquote crazy, maybe he's starting to realize what that sign meant, or that he was given a sign at all. Or, I don't know, the theory that he just wants to rehabilitate these people versus, you know, like Dog Shooter, who's out there for blood.
Just wants to put him down.
Wants to kill Patty, wants to kill...
Which, by the way, Dean's dogs. Worldview is Kevin Sr.'s worldview as well.
It is, yeah, yeah.
Like, and I'm not sure post-apocalypse, post him losing his mind, but the way Dean talks about putting down the dogs is exactly the way Kevin Sr. talks about putting down this deer.
Yeah, and there's a resistance from Kevin for both of those things, right?
Sure.
He doesn't want to kill the dogs, he doesn't want to kill the deer. And in last episode in Cairo, it seemed to be linked to these voices and someone telling him, like, Patty was telling him, look, you just don't understand yet, like, now you understand, now that we've had this discussion.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where they left it with Kevin.
Right.
So I'm not totally sure what the deer mean, but I feel like it's Kevin trying to resist these darker tendencies or maybe a particular idea about what happened with the departure.
Let's follow this through. So we find out later when he tracks down the deer and the deer rampages through a school. That connects this deer with Nora, because that's where Nora's children go.
Yeah.
And we see, in fact, her husband's preschool teaching mistress is the one that kind of asked, late, you know, Kevin's like, is it okay? That connects them. It rampages through the family, the elderly couple that has the middle-aged son with Down syndrome.
Uh-huh.
And we later see it get ran over by Kevin's fling, his hookup, his slam piece, and it's got a Mylar balloon that says it's a girl stuck in its horns.
Yeah, which obviously was reflecting the sun, which made it appear, yeah.
Which is very cool, because I remember when I saw that in a preview, I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What the fuck? Is that it's a girl in reference to the fetus that Lori's caring about that Kevin has no knowledge of? And in fact, it's pretty clear in the present day he doesn't know about that deep, dark secret either.
Sure.
Or is that something that is presaging Holy Wayne's child through Christine?
Christine. So I don't want to get spoilery, and obviously I can't. I haven't seen the next episode.
I was going to say, what the fuck?
But I have seen I have not seen the preview, but I've seen kind of the name, The Prodigal Son Returns. Uh-huh. That might be considered spoilery by some people. But we got to talk about it. Okay. Because that has the potential to see Tom come back.
Well, that was something people speculated last week that, you know, where now that Tom has cut off Wayne, he can't contact him. Wayne's got no way to contact
him.
Where's
he going to go?
It seems, especially seeing that their relationship is pretty close.
Yeah.
That he's going to, and he tried, you know, out of desperation, he was this close to calling his dad before. In fact, he did call his dad. Then Holy Wayne showed up and gave him the phone, and that threw him the lifeline. I feel like it's not a spoiler to say that he's probably going to come back.
Okay.
So
if that's the case, potentially Kevin could remember this incident. I mean, it is kind of a weird incident, right? A deer is rampaging through your town. You saw it with this crazy light on its head, and it turns out to be a balloon. That's something you might remember.
Well, not only that, but it's arguable that when the deer came back into Kevin's life, obviously not the same deer, because he executed it Pulp Fiction style.
Sure.
Which apparently is a big panty dropper with the ladies.
Yeah, no.
You fucking shoot a deer in between, put out of his mercy, and you're getting in.
Wait, was he in his sweatpants at that point? Because no. That might have been what did it.
No, he was
All right.
not.
All right.
I don't know. Maybe he had his fly unzipped. But what was it? Shit, was I going to this? Oh, so the deer returns. The timing's about right for when Wayne conceived the child with Christine. And it's still the evidence of it fucking up his kitchen is still there. I wonder if that would further jog his memory, and I wonder if we're supposed to believe that some of – and again, this show continues to do an amazing job of straddling the line between metaphysical and physical, right?
Sure.
Like you said, that was a big blazing holy cross in the deer's head until we found it was a Mylar bag.
Yeah.
But you've got to – the other thing we have to realize is we're dealing with crazy or on the brink of being crazy people that interpret signs and symbolisms.
Patty, clearly crazy at this point.
And I'm
– Kevin – potentially crazy in the future. His dad going to be crazy in the future.
And I can't even find fault, because again, one of the things that I've approached the show is when something insane happens, I don't know. And I know it's something that you and I disagree on. I don't know that you can classify things as sane and insane reactions.
Okay. I mean,
you know,
I might be with you there. Yeah.
Right. So
everybody's going to react differently. All I can do is portray it from my perspective, right?
Perhaps the deer will make another return when Tommy comes back, and this is setting up that Tom and Kevin Senior and Junior and Dean are maybe going to be the protectors of Christine.
It could be. Does it tie in with Joe releasing that dog at all last episode?
Well, and is it, because you got to think if Tommy comes back.
Mm-hmm.
Nora has experience with Holy Wayne. He's joined Holy Wayne's cult. Does his dad know that? Will that come out? Will Nora throw her support behind, you know, like how deep is this interconnected rabbit hole going to go? I mean, you could see this becoming, and it could be, that's the brilliant thing is this series could develop into this Don Quixote type thing where you've got a whole bunch of crazy people doing a bunch of crazy things that have no relation to reality.
Sure.
Yet something supernatural did kick all this stuff off. So you can't also write off the supernatural elements.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, the question early on of whether the dog shooter's real and are the bagels real and that kind of stuff really struck a chord with people.
Sure, sure.
Because the event itself, the whole genesis of this series is based on something that appears very supernatural.
Right. And by the way, I've got a lot of links in the show notes for this article. I'm going to link the wiki article for Hubertus. I've got an interesting article that Cynthia B. sent in about Michelle McLaren's take on some stuff from last episode that I was really surprised by. But okay. I just want you to know that if you're looking to get some more information about this stuff, you can look it up. I'm trying to think what else.
So is this whole episode how Kevin got dubbed the dog catcher? Because they kind of make a joke about that, right? Like him being a dog catcher. He's running after this deer with a tranquilizer gun chasing all over town.
Sure, sure.
The other officers are going to make fun of him for that.
He's turned into Colin Hanks from Fargo all of a sudden. And also, this kind of general lack of respect that the people had towards Kevin Jr., you can see even this 3.5 years ago. Because this chief, his dad, seems like this towering figure in the community. And he's like, you know, connected with the religious elements, and like the whole town comes out for his birthday and everybody loves him, respect him. He's in the mayor's, the mayoral candidate who's now the mayor's pants. Also that relationship makes a lot more sense because you see Kevin Sr. in the uniform, he's looking trim. He's got the cool mustache. He's got a nice haircut and he's very confident.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I can see why.
Far cry from streaking through a backyard.
I can see why they would build a relationship working with each other on the council and through the campaign and sparks fly. And
yeah, it makes sense.
Totally. Kevin Sr. seems like the type of guy that could pull down the mayor. So I'm saying,
sure.
So that's kind of Kevin's arc.
Do we want to talk any about how he pretends to be happy and how, I mean, we talked slightly about it.
Sure.
But
let's talk about how the guilty remnant, the deer, and the dogs all have stuff in common. What about the stag being a stand-in for Kevin? Because, you know, it's not speculation. Several characters say, including Kevin himself, he feels trapped in his life. There should be something more out there. This deer does not belong where he's at. He finds himself continually constrained and being injured by being, trapped and put in constraints. Kevin feels an empathy for him.
So it makes me wonder if that is not a commentary that the show is trying to make on the event itself, saying, like with Kevin Sr. telling him, look, this is it. This is fucking it. You're looking for something else. Everyone has that desire to find meaning where there may not necessarily be meaning. In this case, there isn't.
Right.
This is it. The event just happened.
Sure.
The departure happened. There is no meaning to it. And this is reflected on the subreddit as well. I see so many theories.
Oh my God.
Going around saying, what happened? What does this tell us about the departure itself? I don't think this tells us anything about the departure itself. Nothing. Because the book, as far as I know, does not say why or what happened exactly.
Right.
Damon Lindelof has said, you will never know the answer to the question why this happened.
Yes.
Or what caused it or how it happened. We need to stop thinking about that. Is this episode also trying to tell us to stop thinking about that?
Well,
like, don't expect the finale to give you those answers because it won't.
No.
This is fucking
I feel
it.
Confident saying you're not going to get answers of why the, you know, was it aliens? Was it God? Why were these people taken? Why were these other people not taken? It does. The more we know about it, the more kind of interesting slash disturbing slash controversial things it brings up, which we'll talk
definitely
about a little bit later in the episode, I imagine. But I think what it can tell us is why people are reacting the way they are now.
Sure.
Like,
and that's the most that's the only interesting part.
And it seems like it is all about the guilt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guilt you feel towards wanting something to be different or wanting some people to go away, even if it's just a momentary flash of annoyance. You know, like Nora, I don't think I have much to say about her other than, you know, her quest in this episode was to be more than a mom.
Yeah.
To she needs something for herself. She's tired of being the juice box hero.
And she might even be slightly annoyed with her kids.
And that's fine.
People get annoyed with their kids, and that's a natural reaction.
And you see the first day where she's the hero, and they're in this big, adorable puppy pile in the bed, and the, yeah, you know, the dog's there, and everything.
But that seemed like the best day
for them. And then the next, it wasn't quite the beach, you know, level of, she said. And the next day wasn't quite everybody in the flu and being sick. But, you know, that happens in families, and you can scream, God damn it, why didn't you use two hands at your child? But if your whole family disappeared
the moment after you,
the moment you're screaming and wishing they'd just go away so you get this goddamn job interview and get a little bit of your life back.
Yeah.
I don't know how you deal with that.
Absolutely.
And you meant you,
and if you're Kevin and you've just decided I'm going to cheat on my wife with this woman and you had seen the deer earlier, which could be interpreted as a sign, and now poof, this woman's gone right before your eyes.
Well, so that
also has
that's
to,
a key.
You have
right?
to start wondering: am I being told something? Should I feel extra guilty about this because of those events?
Well, one of the things the Wonder Twins talked about when they're out with Amy and Jill was that one of the speculation of the pack of dogs, the feral dogs and animals, are they are the ones that saw people disappear.
Yeah,
Kevin's going crazy. He saw someone disappear. If indeed. Lori saw her child disappear in the monitor, that would show her cracking. Maybe she was completely genuine about,
you know, thinking that... She definitely didn't see it happen, though, because, like, her head's turned to the other side, and then she turns over, and she notices, oh, it's
gone. Well, they were staring at the screen when the woman screamed. Unless that scream was a distraction from the real event, though. And maybe that's why she's not really crazy. She's just guilty.
Or there's
guilty.
Delay on the screen.
Because there's a lot of people that are guilty, and then there's a lot of people that are crazy. And I wonder if the difference between the one or the other is actually witnessing it. Because we were just talking about, speaking of hard to get over, you're about to or in the middle of fucking someone, and they just disappear underneath you.
Yeah, and you know this act is wrong already.
And again, put you in a world that, it's just like you and I, like, you don't, this is not something that can happen, but it has happened.
How do you interpret that event?
Like, we were kind of laughing at Kevin going through the sheets, but what is a sane reaction to the woman you're having sex with disappearing into thin air or pop or whatever?
I don't know. There is no sane reaction because we don't think it's ever happened.
First, you got to finish yourself off before the goal one. I mean, what?
No, you're right.
But after that, all bets are off. All bets are off.
Then you check the sheets.
Get a black light out. No. I don't know how even a Holy Wayne hug helps with that. And that really, to me, explains what Nora's pathos was throughout these episodes, because that just would be very hard.
That would be very difficult.
Alan Sepinwall drew a parallel with the monkey's paw, where this is like perverse wish fulfillment. Kevin doesn't want to be trapped, so, and he doesn't even understand why his family's disintegrating, but it does. You know, his son saw people commit suicide as a probably reaction to the rapture or the departure.
Jill had someone's hand she was holding just
disappear. I don't think she was actually physically holding the hand.
Oh, she wasn't?
No.
Somebody was holding that hand.
Right, and that person's probably...
But Jill was there.
She
saw it. She saw the light go out.
Yeah, and Lori, I mean, so Kevin wanted to not be trapped, and now he's kind of not trapped. It also explains how, you know, we're like, how is the guilty remnant getting their money? You know, and we speculate there's no way they could afford it to actually order that many. But Lori looked like she's fucking loaded.
Well, we know they didn't order that many, right? They gave an envelope full of like 20 grand to
somebody. That could have been a bribe to deliver it, because I don't...
But it's like a down payment on those things. They could definitely afford that, probably given Lori's salary alone.
I think they could just outright buy them, and that was a bribe to deliver it to them instead of the people's houses. Because I don't think, like, say that you are the loved one's doll company, and the guilty remnant orders 37 dolls of a bunch of different people's likenesses in the town. They want it delivered to their cult headquarters.
Yeah,
that would set off a lot of PR bells and legal bells and all kinds of stuff. But if you don't, but you contact someone in shipping and bribe them 20 grand to get a U-Haul out there and deliver them to you, that I can, that seems to start everything starts coming together.
Sure. And your point is that Lori probably had.
And why they have 100. Yeah, like
plenty of money.
It's not just all of the people going there and surrendering their assets. It's that all those people plus a couple rich, eccentric people doing it, and you're suddenly loaded.
So take the section of the episode where Patty is talking with Lori, and she's talking to her about, you know, leaving her husband's house and that it's his house. He paid for it.
Yeah.
What kind of, what do you think happened with Lori and Kevin right after the departure? When Lori decides I'm going to the GR, my possessions are things that I'm giving to the GR.
She obviously ordered him out of the house. Yeah.
Because he is not living in the same conditions that he was living, in his flashback.
He's living in his dad's old place.
Yeah.
So
she gave the house, gave all of her money.
Yeah.
Everything to the GR.
Guilty remnant, yep.
He's got to be bitter about that, right?
There's multiple layers.
I mean, that's
layers.
What they're setting us up for right there. Lori herself is saying, it's both of your houses. But then later on, she's going to have a change of heart when she goes to join the GR.
Well, and I'm sure Patty aided and abetted to that as well. Do you think,
sure.
So one of the questions I have, so let's stay with the Lori. I feel like we really handled Kevin's plot here. You know,
yeah,
by and
no,
large.
Let's go to the other side of...
Let's go to Lori and Patty.
Yeah, let's go to the other side of the departure where you don't have the people who feel guilty about it. You have the people who feel validated by it in Patty.
So are we seeing how these cults can proliferate? That we've got people that have crazy views.
Yeah.
And this is a cognitive bias. Like I was talking to somebody in email. Might have been Michael P. Might have been somebody else. But... We're going back and forth about, you know, experiences that you get, and it's kind of like the deja vu, or like you're listening to a radio station, or you're thinking about a song, you flip on the radio, and that song's playing.
Yeah.
That's like a bias, that sure. The dozens of times you've been thinking about a song and flipping on a radio or turning on a TV and you don't hear anything, you don't remember.
Yep.
You remember the one time where circumstances align that coincidence happened, and you're like, ooh, that's spooky.
Yeah.
So, Patty... has been talking for months, apparently, about mm-hmm. the end of the world coming. And she's saying the same thing every single time. For 2% of the world did end on this date. That's going to stick out in Lori and her and everyone else's mind as being significant. Again, sure. I think that's fascinating how this supernatural event sets off other, apparently, supernatural events. So then you got the guilty remnant. You got, you know, maybe Wayne was kind of off kilter and crazy, and then this happened, and apparently he lost his son. At least that's what we think.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's got this complex. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. The idea that, you know, you can have the Harold Camping-esque prediction of the end of the world. That actually comes true one of the many times they predict it.
That's like I said in, I think, the pilot episode. Like, if you had, like, who'd you say his name was?
Harold Camping.
He's the guy that did the one in 2012, right?
Yes, yeah.
So you get, like, the Mayan calendar and the Campmans of the world, and something sure. crazy like a meteor does strike the Earth. Mm-hmm. I've always said that would be the end of rational thought for hundreds of years, because people would, like, anyone that said that wasn't God would be rounded up, getting put against the walls and shot, because don't want to piss God off anymore. That's my personal belief.
Okay.
Reasonable, you can disagree, but I feel like that's kind of what we're seeing here. A less extreme version of that really resonates with a lot of people, though, and makes them have radical departures in the way they live.
Yeah, yeah, and it happens with Patty here, and I think this points to the idea that maybe she gets into Lori's head and starts to become a prophet to Lori.
Sure, somehow.
I mean, I don't know how else... it's hard to say, because maybe she does find out about Kevin's infidelity... And that drives her away and naturally to the GR.
I don't think so. I don't think she...
I mean, there's no indication really that she knows.
Except for Patty said something about his dirty dick, but that could just be a lucky guess.
Yeah, and there's...
The reason she really went away, we now know, is because she lost a baby during the apparent departure.
We think so.
think so.
We think that's why she went to the GR. So she starts to believe what Patty says because of those predictions that she had been making.
That's...
I feel like a psychologist would be almost immune to that sort of rationalization.
All right. Well, let me ask a couple other things just throw out there. She looks at this one day calendar that's got, like, you know, your positive thought or your outside the box thought or your touchy feely thought of the day.
Yeah.
And
your foot is...
The foot feels the foot when it feels the ground.
Sure.
Also, interestingly enough, she's got a little thing rigged up at her office that when someone comes into her vestibule or waiting area, it shines a red light. Red lights are very significant in this episode. This series. They seem to be pointing towards some sort of divine...
Yeah.
Yeah, or they could just be a faulty stoplight. We talked about
that,
too.
Could be a red
arrow,
but,
yeah. You know, it signaled Matt to do the gambling thing. It also... fired off when Matt was in the car with Kevin and they almost got in a wreck. Is that just a wink and a nod, or are we supposed to get that this Patty character has got some sort of divine connection?
Yeah, I think especially with the stuff we saw in Cairo from her, she certainly feels like she has a higher purpose. And The trouble is they're walking such a fine line here, right? Between Patty actually being fucking crazy and Patty being a prophet of some kind and in touch with some other layer of reality. And I think that's kind of where that foot feeling the foot feel the ground thing comes in. Like, and you can even apply that to Kevin's life here. Like, there is another... There's more than what's just going on the surface that you can see.
Yeah.
There's like a disconnection between senses and reality. And even if you take a look at the animals' reactions to events here, if you want to go with the idea that the deer is not just reacting to this balloon, the deer is prophetic in some kind of way or has a deeper understanding, as like when animals are sensing a hurricane coming because, like, barometric pressure drops and stuff.
Yeah.
They have different kinds of connections with the planet
world.
Because they have different senses that we don't have.
Sure.
That sort of thing can come into it, too, where maybe Patty has some connection beyond the senses that we as humans experience.
Sure.
So I feel like the whole episode is riding that line right down the middle.
No, and I
the whole series is really riding that line, like we've talked about.
And again, this would be interesting if this turns out to be some final prophecy type deal where it's really good and evil. And it's the stand. You got Randall Flagg versus the white mother or whatever the hell her name was.
Versus Rob
Stark.
Rob Lowe.
Yes, Rob Lowe.
Yep.
I think would be super interesting is a Don Quixote tilting at imaginary windmills that you think are – no, the real windmills that you think are giants.
Uh-huh.
I think either one would be super entertaining.
I don't think we'll ever get an answer.
And that's fine too, as long as it continues to be interesting.
Sure.
I don't know. So let me ask – we meet Gladys. Mm-hmm. She's a dog breeder of – adorable puppies.
Yeah, nothing like that dog in the backyard last episode.
And as Lori's holding one of them, she's like, oh my God, won't, you know, they miss their mother or something. And Gladys says, it's completely natural. They don't need her anymore. That this is the third litter. Lori would have had three children. I just wonder if Lori, Gladys, and Patty got together and these various bits of their former life formed into a stew that became, is Patty the one that started the guilty remnant? Is it possible that this started here and then spread?
What did she say last episode about that? Didn't she mention
something about the
other chapters?
She refused to mention, like, their organization structure or how they communicate or anything like that.
Okay.
Kevin tried to press, and she's
yeah.
Yo, fuck you. We're not going to talk about that.
Huh.
So, again...
Is that what the head of this thing would say?
Might say, right?
Yeah.
That's good. I don't think it matters one way or another. It's just something interesting to think about.
I mean, with her predicting the end of the world, I could definitely see her... feeling completely validated by this and say, I am not crazy. Everyone who doesn't believe me is crazy. And I'm going to get these people to understand that.
Mm. I'm just imagining those
by
like
smoking and wearing white.
Those fluffy puppies turning feral and, you know, trying to maul her, and that just put her off a living, you know, poor Gladys.
Sure. No, we also find some other stuff about Patty with the bag of shit in Neil's door. We find out that Lori basically told her to do that.
Yes. And this is a callback, which you think that's an interesting thing for a cult leader to do with your cult acolyte. To call back that, and you know, you're supposed to like, you're
remember
not
when I was crazy?
You're not supposed to wait. Well, she puts this stuff out that seems like it's bullshit. Like, you know, we become a blank slate where all we do is think about the departure, unless we're also thinking about Neil and shitting in a bag and eating waffles. Like, I still
where I go back before.
There's significance to that whole episode that it would be interesting after the we get done watching this, a rewatch I feel like would be super rewarding, because some of the stuff is gonna make sense, or maybe in hindsight it's like, what the fuck. But
no, I think they've brought a lot more clarity to the situations of all these people in this episode. Mm-hmm. We had speculated so much about these characters, and I think most of it ended up being exactly what we thought. But to actually see it play out, I think, is valuable.
Well, because also it helps us pare down. Because a lot of people had theories about it. I know that the Lori fetus theory was discussed. I absolutely know. And I can't remember which listener sent it in.
But stuff like Nora. We were basically told everything that happened to Nora.
Right.
In other episodes.
But we didn't know the circumstances of her disappearing and why. And so I got... anyway... let me continue. What do you make of Kevin and Tommy's discussion in the car after Tommy tries to violently meet his biological father for the third time, and Kevin kicks the guy's ass? But he says, you know, what he did to your mother and you was terrible, and he shouldn't get to pretend like it didn't happen, but sometimes to deal with that, you have to pretend. That feels like another significant statement that I'm not sure exactly how it's going to tie into everything.
Yeah. So it depends on what he did.
Is that why Kevin feels so trapped? Because he wants out, but he can't bring himself to do that to this family and to his
again,
daughter.
Yeah. To have those people go through this again would be rough. That might very well be the case. Yeah.
Did you think it was interesting that Jill was by far the most happy-go-lucky person in the show?
Yeah.
But yet, when her brother started to get real with her at the science fair, it cracked her veneer pretty quickly. Maybe she was trying really hard to be chipper and happy, and you're the best mom, and I love you, Dad, and I love you, big brother, just to kind of keep things together. And once it all flies apart, she immediately goes into goth mode. Yep. She flips the switch from bubbly teenager to goth. The braces explode off her teeth.
Pretty much, yeah.
She starts choking dudes where they're jerking off, and the rest is history.
It's clear that not all is well for her. It's just like everyone else in this episode, right? Mm-hmm. They've got secrets. They've got feelings that they're not talking about. I don't know. Is it significant that Kevin is willing to talk about this with his father, but no one else?
I don't know.
Why do they have this discussion, but he won't discuss this with his wife? He won't discuss this with anyone else.
You talk about things with your dad that you maybe not talk about things with significant others, and there's some things you talk to your significant others you wouldn't talk
to your
dad. I'm
just asking, is it significant in the plot of The Leftovers or this episode?
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
Maybe not.
Let's see, what else?
Foul-mouthed Kevin Sr., man. he walks in to a surprise party. Motherfuckers.
Sure.
I love it.
What do you think about the women in the car? They pull up to Kevin when
That's
he's in the middle of a
weird.
Run, and they're like, are you ready? And then, oh, I thought you're someone else. No sooner they pull over than the manhole cover explodes. Again, they laid the groundwork with their gas line being worked on and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, in Kevin Jr.'s mind, all this stuff kind of adds up, and I wonder if that's informing some of his fire dreams.
I hadn't considered that.
Although I still think there's a perfect explanation for his fire dream being the fact that he was smelling smoke from his fence being on fire.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know, maybe I'm looking too much into that.
I honestly don't know what the car was about. I wish I had a better understanding of that because...
Because so let's say
a lot of people have speculated on it,
and let's say there's some speculation that we are definitively against, like yes. the fact that this is a pre-cult, or these were some people say, oh, the two women in the back seat are Asian. Number one, not true. Number two,
yes,
there can't be a Holy Wayne / Guilty Remnant cult yet.
What's the name of this cult?
Guilty Remnant.
What does that mean?
The remnant is the things left after something else happens.
Right?
There's no fucking way. And they're all about remembering. It's like,
yeah, now, it would have to be a cult that co-opted this event for their purposes.
Now that's an interesting thing because, you know, if you ask a Jehovah's Witness what their founder was, they'd say Charles Taze Russell.
Sure,
Charles Taze Russell would call bullshit on that because the modern Jehovah's Witnesses don't look anything like. In fact, there's four other organizations that split off and still, you know, the International Bible students, and what else?
Yep, yep.
That all claim this common cause. So now, is this car full of women a precursor to these cults that they then decide that they're going to take a left turn at Albuquerque and go off in their own direction? That would be interesting. But these people are not Guilty Remnant, nor are they Holy Wayne recruiters, nor are they third eye blind target forehead people, nor are they the pantsless men.
Yeah, yeah.
We have no idea what they are. I can't even speculate.
I don't have an idea. I have no idea what this scene means in context for the rest of the episode.
And maybe this is what Lindelof is trying to say. This is all just a bunch of crazy coincidences that have nothing to do with anything that this event gave significance to. Maybe they're just women that were that were going to pick up somebody they're expecting. And
only because we know that the event is about to happen
does that gain significance.
Should that mean anything to us? Yeah.
Right.
That's an interesting thought. It's also interesting, I guess, to just say there are a lot of signs during this episode.
Sure.
And that could be one of the unsettling signs for Kevin, that these people ask, are you ready?
Sure.
For him. And then all of a sudden this thing happens. I don't know. What I really want is an episode that picks up where this one left off.
Okay. No,
and shows us initial reactions. We've gotten the 3-year out reaction. I want the initial reaction.
Yeah. I don't know that we have any other things to talk about. We've got a lot of stuff that is in the feedback that are things I want to talk about, but we might as well, you know, might as well talk about them in the form of feedback.
Sure.
I will want to. There's one other thing that some sharp-eyed readers on Reddit saw, that the time on the baby monitor was listed. There's a time and date. It was October 14th, 2011, which definitely sets the time period.
Okay, yeah.
As basically contemporary. It's an alternate universe version of our world. And the time was 2:23. Genesis
2:23:48. Let's put the whole thing there so you can call bullshit when you want to.
right. OBGY Genesis 2:23 says, the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. Referring to God thieving a rib bone from us dudes and
in
forming.
In this case, he thieved a baby.
And forming a and for, well, really, I mean,
if you're taking a
children
rib,
are gifts from God, so he's just reneging at best.
Sure. But if you're taking a rib and making a whole nother sex out of it,
yeah.
What are you doing with a full baby? That's what I want to know.
Ooh.
What is he going to make with that?
Galactus. It's going to come back to eat the earth at season 3. That's how you say fuck you to a fan base, Lindelof. Just either that or watch the finale of True Blood. Jesus.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Anyway, there's another reference to the It's a Girl. It's another kind of quasi-prophet. Yep. Could it be a reference to the baby? None of these can be in reference to Lori's baby because there's no significance to her having a boy or a girl, right?
Not that we know of, no.
The only time that we've seen any kind of dramatic significance to the It's a Girl is Holy Wayne promising a boy who's going to be a bridge and Christine getting
a girl. Yeah.
But I have no idea how that stuff all ties together. Or if the Garveys are intended to be her guardian, or they're going to be her shepherd, or what the hell's happening.
And this could just be set up for next episode.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Shall we do a little bit of pimping and get into feedback?
Sounds good.
Okay. You know, let me break my normal flow and talk about some things that we're actually excited about up and coming. Number one, Boardwalk Empire is coming back September 7th. It's the final season. it is. Well, now that Breaking Bad's off the air.
Oh, I feel.
No, I mean,
I
like,
feel there's something big coming here.
The best show on television.
I can't. That's hard for me to say, man. It's really hard for me to say. I will say that Boardwalk Empire's finales are, if you just consider the finales and the setup that gets them there, there are some of the best hours of television I've ever seen.
And yet,
like,
completely snubbed at the Emmys.
Well, yeah, of course. You know, Steve Buscemi just can't win. Because, again, how if you just watch the finale without their other episodes, it's like you might think, what's the big deal?
Sure.
But they're so satisfying to pay off. I'll put those 3 hours of television, the season finale for 2, 3, and 4, up against any other. They're definitely in my top 10. Super excited about it being the final season. Walking Dead comes back.
We're definitely covering it. Like, I don't know that we've said that anywhere.
No, we're definitely covering it day one.
Full podcast.
No Bald Move TV bullshit. We're just jumping in. Walking Dead comes back October 12th.
Yeah.
I'm not joking when I say this. I'm actually very excited after seeing the Comic-Con trailer.
I saw that at Comic-Con. I was blown away.
And we're going to talk about that leading up to it.
They could just shit all over everything I think is going to happen.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping will happen, but the preview looked good.
We've got some stuff coming out in September that's going to kind of prep us for this. We're going to be doing live streaming the Walking Dead Telltale Adventure series.
Yeah, we're going to play through those.
Our intention is to play through those leading up. So we'll be live streaming that, and they'll be on YouTube.
And we're going to be doing a chat while we do that. So if you guys want to just like come hang out and talk with us,
yeah, you don't.
That's a pretty good place to do it.
Have to watch us play the game. You could just come in and hang out with us.
Sure. Well, I think we're going to do it on Twitch TV, so we'll have the chat room up there. We'll post links and everything and give you guys notice when we do it.
But that's super exciting. We've got a couple other surprises along the way too that we'll be talking about as things get closer. But look for that. The September being the lead up to Walking Dead. Going on to Straight Up Pimping. Oh, one other thing. We just completed a series of videos about the video game FTL.
Oh, yeah.
Where
yeah.
Jim and I get our asses kicked by this brutally hard game. it's 3 volumes, couple hours of content. If you like video games, and that one in particular, and you want to see us board the struggle bus intergalactically, check that out on youtube.com/baldmove. We've added a new way you can support Bald Move. People have been clamoring for it. Surprisingly, they just want to give us money with no expectation of anything in return.
What are you doing, people?
These are the Patties and Lorries of the world that are unhinged and are waiting for some apocalypse to lead us all into, you know, a garment.
We're going to take one possession a day.
Garments of radiant white. That's one plan you can sign up for, but you go to baldmove.com/support and you can just straight up donate through PayPal to us if you don't want to do any other horse shit. But if you do, we got a couple ways you can do that too. Subbable.com/baldmove. You can convert your money into content opportunities and other cool Bald Move memorabilia. Amazon.baldmove.com is a great way if you're using Amazon to support us. It's affiliate link. You use that, and every time you buy something, we get a little bit in return. It doesn't cost you anything. That's cool. Finally, if you can't do or not inclined to do any of that, could you find in your heart to tell friends and family members about Bald Move? Spread the love. You can do that by sharing us on social media. And another great way is to go on iTunes. If you're listening to iTunes, subscribe, rate, and review. All helps us grow our network, and we appreciate everything y'all do to support us. Just reminder, there is no leftovers next week, but we will be having a special. Is this an official podcast? Our first official.
What are we
doing? I have to ask Tanner. Can we actually call ourselves for this week only an official podcast? Speculating about what's going on in the finale. Please send us your feedback about that at leftovers@baldmove.com or on our Facebook or Twitter. Let's get right into feedback. Got a couple from last week I thought was interesting. Matt S. says, is it possible that they actually bought the body dummies legitimately, using the photos they stole to design the body mummy dummies? I was down on this theory in the last
Until
2 weeks
Lori's
because
money.
I just couldn't conceive of the money that would. But now that Lori is fucking rich, this is starting to seem like it's a strong possibility. We kind of talked about that.
Yeah, what are you guessing, like?
That house is
$2 million in upstate New York. $1.5 million?
Or more accurately, as someone said, a street that's a suburb of New York City.
Yeah.
That's got to be a several-million-dollar home, right?
You'd think so. Yeah.
And if she's paying the mortgage on that, then, and maybe she comes from money.
Maybe.
You know, or she's just built up this multi-million-dollar practice a year. I don't know, but she's definitely loaded. Glenn Beeson in a missive, we wondered about the 378 Ware that was spray painted on the side of of the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
He actually looked up because he's a former Lutheran, I believe, or maybe he just found this information. He looked up the Lutheran hymns, the epiphanies, the stuff that was posted to Matt's board.
Mm-hmm.
378 is the title of one of these hymns called "Oh, Where Are Kings and Empires Now?" And the text of it, I will include this hyperlink as well in the show notes. But it's someone saying, you know, where are the kings and empires that have fallen throughout human history? They've all gone, but the one, the church and Christ's kingdom is the one thing that's endured throughout all. So he's basically suggesting that this 378 where is people saying, you know, where is God?
Hmm.
Maybe the kingdom is actually gone. I thought that was really interesting. Cynthia B. sent in a link of Michelle McLaren breaking down five key scenes from last week's Cairo episode.
All right.
On Watching the Leftovers, again, the official site with HBO.
Anything interesting in there?
One thing that I want to highlight.
Okay.
Michelle is under the impression that Dean could still not be real.
Dog shooter?
And she staged several scenes to be suggestive of him perhaps being illusion. In particular, there's one scene where he's standing up against a window in the opposite wall. There's a quick cut to Kevin, and then a quick cut back to them, and he's now sitting down across the other side of the room on a couch. And she wanted to suggest that he might have just teleported there.
So is this...
But this is bullshit, right?
It's... Okay, so...
Michelle McLaren, great director... But some bullshit that you're trying to suggest here.
Is this a case of the show writers and the people making this thing wanting to keep that question alive and figuring that they've still got us on the hook for that and just not realizing that they have given up the ghost on that a long time ago?
Well, okay. First of all, we, and when I say we, I'm talking about everybody listening to this podcast.
I'm talking about the audience, everyone, watching the show.
And I'm talking about the people who listen to this podcast and post it on Reddit. We're like the top 1% of people that are really sifting the tea leaves and
sure,
throwing chicken bones in the fire and seeing which way they pop.
So she's speaking to the other 99% who
don't. I'm sure there's a lot of people who just grab the man on the street, one of these 1.89 million people watching, and say, is Dean real? They'd probably be like, well, maybe he is, maybe he's not.
I could say, yes, he is, and I can give you specific instances where the entire fucking police force has seen him and talked to him.
And then investigated him.
How could that possibly not have happened?
If he's not real, then we are being lied to as viewers in a way that goes beyond unreliable narration and goes into just fuckery.
Yeah.
However, I do think that there's probably a little bit of that. Because, again, I wonder if Michelle, when she's directing this episode, knows all the beats that came before it. You know,
maybe she doesn't, but I feel like, you know, she works with Damon Lindelof on this and says,
sure.
And Damon's telling her, hey, keep it a little ambiguous.
No, and
that's just his style.
That's,
right?
That's almost a direct quote. She's like, you know, when I was reading the scripts and the material, there seems to be some ambiguity. So I think this was her helping that out. But but still, it seems like preponderance of evidence suggests that he's a real person.
I can't see it any other way.
No.
I really can't.
Interesting link, and there's a bunch of other cool shot analysis and what she's trying to get to that.
Take this as just a mind fuck. A not real guy talking to invisible people. Like, what kind of meta level is that where you've got Dean the dog shooter who's not real?
Yeah.
Potentially talking to voices that he's hearing in his head.
Right. And that
how far are we going to go down this rabbit
hole? And that Kevin is falsifying memories of his own officers saying that they're talking to people and like
the stretch you have to make that true.
And that he had a fever dream where he stood up in town hall and only he saw him and he's just standing there slack-jawed for 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Randy G on Facebook said the song that Jill is totally butchering in one of the opening scenes is Without You by David Guetta and featuring Usher. Okay. Fun little factoid about that from searching the song title. Turns out the video that was released, presumably that's when the single was too, October 14th, 2011.
All right.
So
that's cool.
Pretty
October
cool.
14th.
Marianne RBH said, moral of the story, fracking will end, bring about the end of the world. This is a gas line joke. Fracking.
Oh, okay.
You're thinking, you're going fracking toaster, weren't you? You're all in up in Cylon land over there.
Yeah, pretty much.
Michael VC said, as the episode begins, it shows a telephone pole that we saw in the first shot of the pilot. Sans a ribbon this time. Kevin then runs by
Is that what that was?
Yeah, and I...
That was a telephone pole?
I think this is a shot-for-shot stage because... And I didn't realize this until I read his email. Then he runs by the Asian woman's home where they're putting up a big mural of her face in the pilot. This time she's standing outside waving to Kevin.
Okay. I mean, all of it...
He says, I also wonder if she's tied to Wayne at all, or maybe that's racial profiling on my part.
What was the song he was listening to in the first episode?
Oh, fuck. Beats the fuck out of me.
Was it upbeat or was it just completely different?
I couldn't say.
I can't remember either.
Maybe that's something we...
Damn it.
We can look up.
I'm sure our audience will tell us.
Yeah, yeah.
The fans
let's
will
just,
write
Let's just
in
use and, that crutch.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't
research.
Care.
Come
we,
on.
We know, we've got people
tell us.
For that. anyway.
Because it's clear we do no research on this show.
True, true. None. This is a true statement. Yeah. I think this is then segues into Andrew T's comment about, you know, some people are talking about this is about, you know, that this clearly shows that, you know, people who, that the people that lost ones were ones that were wishing that they were gone.
Mm,
okay,
yeah.
Like there's a cause and effect, and Andy T came in and said, I don't think so. I think it's actually a show why people feel super deluxe guilty about the departures. The same way that Matt probably feels terrible about making his wife drive so he could get his lean on. Didn't talk about it in the series, but...
Get pixelated, yeah.
Matt, you know, got apparently his cancer in complete remission and wanted to get drunk. And his wife said, you get drunk, I'll drive. We know she then died in a fatal car accident minutes
later.
Well,
no, she didn't die.
Oh, well, she got...
She's still around.
No, that's right. She got she got comaed or vegetabled.
Yes. Yeah, she has some pretty bad brain damage, apparently.
Yeah. He continues, Kevin's a physical representation of the veneer the whole world has, where everything looks great, but right below the surface, there's a tremendous amount of turmoil ready to erupt,
yeah.
A la the manhole cover or Kevin's dirty D with the deer accident floozy. Nobody is whole, and they're all searching for a metaphysical missing piece, something to make them feel complete, be it a puppy, a biological father, a mistress... 10-14
sure.
Changed that ambiguous absence into a specific one.
And that's what the whole show is kind of about, right?
Right. He also connects the baby disappearance inside of Lori. It's a nice symmetry where something that was inside of Lori was gone while Kevin, something inside him,
oh,
was
Jesus.
Also left. No, something that Kevin
well,
was inside
yeah,
also
had
left.
Himself inside something.
You know what? I actually thought that was
oh
an insightful
God.
Comment, but he's making one of his fucking jokes.
Yes.
I just got
yeah.
trolled
no,
on Facebook. But glad I read it either way.
Was that Andrew T?
Yes, it was.
That fucker. He always does his shit.
Oh, epic. Nate M. from the home of Walmart, Bentonville, Arkansas. Hey, fellas. Just want to say the use of JT's use of the phrase, fuck you, is absolutely epic. His F-bombs are truly ones from a seasoned salty dog, ones that would bitch slap you forehand and backhand at the same time. I've heard some FUs from people that sound like they've never said it before.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like my wife, and ones I thought were pretty damn good from my time in the military. Garvey's fucks are at the top of the list. That fuck you, Lori.
He doesn't sugarcoat it. He doesn't pretend like it's anything other than a fuck you.
Just this dead-eyed fuck you, Lori.
Yeah, he really means it when he
says
it.
Make you question your life decisions, make you question your desire for a puppy.
Like, not why are you telling me to fuck off, but what did I do that made me get this response?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A soul-searing fuck you. Ryan M. said, want to talk about the last reveal of the episode that I think only had been hinted at during the show so far, that Lori's fetus had been departed.
Yeah.
This is actually super controversial for, I think, whichever side of the debate you fall on, obvious reasons. And Ryan continues.
A, they ride the line, they never show it, right?
Sure.
They don't show the disappeared fetus and the
But if
the
fetus was
womb.
Disappeared and that's 2% of humanity, that has profound implications on the abortion debate in this fictionalized alternate reality.
Sure.
Okay? All right?
So explain that a little deeper, because it took me a second before the podcast when we were talking about this to get what you were
saying.
Well,
there's two... So there's two kind of, I guess, main legs of the, you know, rationale for why abortion is, you know, because no one's saying that fetuses are not human tissue.
Sure.
People question whether fetuses at a certain level of development are human beings in the same way that you could debate where like a Terri Schiavo is still a human being that needs to be kept alive, or if in absence of a brain and a personality, is that person a real person? And that's a very heated debate, obviously, because one side sees people murdering people and the other side sees people doing something merciful or respecting another person's body autonomy. There's also, I think, another plank that says that even if you do consider that a human being, no one has a right to die or even degrade their quality of life for another human being. So women are still justified getting an abortion if they're saving their own life or even they're preserving their quality of existence.
Sure.
So I don't think this is like game fucking over abortionists or pro-choice if God decides to rapture out.
It's a fictionalized universe, right? Like,
indeed. And God, by the way, I'm just saying, spontaneous abortion kills more fetuses than everybody put together. So God's got some explaining to do on that front anyway. Anyway, Ryan continues, I want to provide a little context for that reveal in terms of pre-tribulation Christian eschatology, which I used to be super into before I became agnostic. You're talking my language, Ryan. There's a popular concept in modern-day Christianity called the Age of Accountability. This is the belief that God...
7 years old, as evidenced in Boardwalk Empire. 7 years old.
This is the belief that God won't send babies or children to hell when they die because they're basically too young to know any better and be held accountable.
Or six-year-olds, yes.
Most Christians that believe abortion is a sin also believe that souls go straight to heaven even though they hadn't accepted Christ as their savior. The same holds true for young children. The belief is that each person has a point somewhere in their lives, usually around the start of puberty, where God feels they're old enough to be accountable for their sins and are basically old enough to be cast into hell if they're not Christian when they die. Also, please note that there's no actual allusion to the age of accountability in the Bible at all, and that plenty of Christians have differing beliefs on both the age of accountability.
Wait, you're saying that they made this up?
And what kind of eschatology they believe in, if any. I think it might be a little strong to say there's no allusion. Obviously, age of accountability is not in there, but there is definitely verses that people like to pin this belief on.
Okay.
I'm trying to think there's like some Israel things where sons and daughters were judged on the actions of their parents rather than their own merits, you know, and that their being holy saved them, etc. Anyway, most Christians just assume that God is not a big enough dick to send a 20-week-old fetus to hell solely for the sin of pulling on the umbilical cord too hard.
Sure.
And what would a 20-week-old fetus conceive of hell anyway? That would be...
Sure.
What would a 3-month-old baby conceive of hell? I mean, that's another uncomfortable truth is that human babies up until somewhere between 3 to 12 months,
being tortured,
they're human larvae, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Like, oh, this is hell? This is all I've ever known.
Yeah,
like,
right?
This isn't so bad. I could imagine much worse.
Maybe we're all in hell, man.
Oh.
Past the pot brownies. Let's talk about this. So this leads us to the final reveal of Lori, going back to Ryan's email. I first want to congratulate Lindelof and Perota for having the balls to do something that could be this controversial depending on your interpretation. Second, I assume the 2% of his fetuses were taken too, so what the actual fuck? Why would God take 2% of these blank slates and leave the other 98%? And what purpose would aliens have with these fetuses, which, depending on age, are just clumps of cells and tissue? But then again, I guess that's the point of the show. Speaking of which, let's say that Garvey and the deer running over mistress were fucking, and actually she didn't get taken, and Garvey actually was able to get his little Garveys into her, his millions of sperm cells, and 6 to 8. I'm a man. I don't really know how all this coochie stuff works. But these things swam up the canal and implanted her fertilized egg at the moment that those sperm and egg meet. If one of those things got raptured, she wouldn't even know about it.
Why are we speculating about this?
I'm just saying, how far down do you actually go? How far do the turtles stack, you know? Like, does God consider that a baby? Or 2% of fertilized...
I think they stack to the point where they showed us in this episode. we don't have to go much further than that.
All right. But then again, I guess that's the point.
I mean, his real point is something... The fetus got raptured... The show is saying that is a human being, right? Whereas she's clearly in there for an abortion, or considering it at the very least.
Okay. He said, speaking of which, now that we're at the end of the season, would you guys care to talk about the pros and cons of it being God or aliens or option three, some nuclear death ray gone bad?
Pros or cons?
Yeah, like, do we want to talk about what... And I guess that's a fundamental misunderstanding of my desire here, Ryan, is that I'm not super interested in why the departure happened. If it's an Israeli death ray that went bad, I don't know. If it's probably the Large Hadron Collider, I think.
Collide too many Kevin Garvey Jr. hard-ons and you end up with this mess.
Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack here, but I trust my favorite podcasters will do it and not pussy out. I totally think it's interesting that they did something, and I'm actually super interested.
Did they do it on purpose?
I'm also very surprised. Yes, of course they did.
Or did they just say, man, it'd be cool if there was a fetus who was departed from a womb and didn't even think about the implications?
There had to be, in the writer's room, some implications of like, why? But I will say I'm kind of shocked that this hasn't gone out into wider media and been more of a shitstorm. I'm really super shocked,
let's create the shitstorm.
Do you think it's just because this show is not as big a phenomenon as some of the others? Like, if this had been Game of Thrones season four and something like shit like this, or Walking Dead, where 15 million people are watching it. Also, I feel like your average fundamentalist Christian does not watch The Leftovers because they're just put off on the premise altogether.
Maybe. I mean, what would put them off on the basic premise?
If I was a Jehovah's Witness, I would not be watching the show. But I'm saying that the fundamentalist Christians or the type of Christians that would protest abortion clinics and it would take stake and be like, aha, see, or like claim some kind of moral high ground, I don't think watch the show. I could be wrong.
Could be right. I don't know.
I'm just saying, with all the boobies and swearing and...
I think we've spent an inordinate amount of time talking about what is potentially not even in the episode.
A controversy that hasn't even happened.
Yes.
fair point.
Okay.
So there you go, Ryan. Kevin F. said, great episode. I just want to take a moment and give a shout out to the score. I did too, and I meant to say this in the podcast proper, but I forgot to. This music by Max Richter.
Yeah.
That score, as everything was converging, these points, but also kind of haunting and piercing with like these really extremely high like clarinet and flute notes.
Mm-hmm.
I found unbelievably moving, even knowing what I was getting into. And I guess that's the power of music.
Yeah, and then the Leftovers theme is very effective.
Certainly.
They play that in that soft piano music.
Like, I forget the guy's name, but he said, if you just hum that to yourself as you go about your chores, he had the saddest folding.
Make you want to die.
His saddest folding the sheets ever. No, yep. Seriously. That's not something you can run to and have your dick flopping around with.
Mm-mm, no.
Anyway, he continues, it seems like there were some signs the departure was coming as we see weird happenings affecting animals, people, even gas lines. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested in how it happened. It is interesting to see. I agree with that. Yep. Love the callback to the family that Nora interviewed about losing their disabled son early in the season. Mm-hmm. I love how the show just decided to throw that in there. He wondered if the score affected us in the final moments, and how did signs prior to departure affect our view of it at all? I feel like we've talked about both those things adequately.
I think so. Yeah, that score... It really brought those scenes together, and I think probably the most affecting was Nora's.
Sure, that's the one that,
because we've seen so much of her current story, her struggle with the idea that her family disappeared after she kind of wished them away.
Yeah, no, and I feel like if you're a parent, or even if you're, you know, I'm sure you've got a brother, you've said things to your brother that's been shitty from time to time, and if he just disappeared before your eyes right after that, you'd feel like a fucking asshole.
Sure.
So I think everyone can kind of identify with that, and you throw Richter's music on top of it, and you just want to slit your wrist. Pablo L. says, holy shit, For 8 episodes, I knew The Leftovers wasn't perfect. This episode, however, just brought one of the shortcomings to light.
Oh.
It's dialogue. If you strip away the jaded and overall desolate circumstances of the quote-unquote event, the people of this small town in Upper New York are laughably howdy-dowdy, well, shucks kind of folks. Seriously, they're cookie cutouts of a perfectly happy people you find in the terrible these terrible family films.
That's the point.
Only this fine bunch of folks curse like proverbial sailors.
That's what? The point, man. They're supposed to look happy when they're not.
Right? Do you find the dialogue uninspiring? It does seem...
I don't know. Like, even
it
if
does
it
seem
is...
basic. Like steamed broccoli. The dialogue in this show is steamed broccoli, no butter, no salt.
Mm,
with some pepper.
My favorite.
In the form of fuck bombs. Yeah,
it's hard to say that the dialogue is bad in an episode where the point of them is to show how they look happy, but they're not.
No, he's talking about the whole like compare this season of The Fall, the Leftovers, hadn't done that in a while. The Leftovers with some dialogue from Fargo or fuck True Detective.
Mm-hmm.
That's some dialogue you can sink your teeth into.
Dialogue,
this.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe it's intentionally bland to just really, it's kind of Spartan and austere the way the series is. There's not a lot of flowery things said. It's a lot of, you know.
Yeah. I mean, these are plain folk.
Plain
folk. In a plain town, right?
Plain folk. Like Greek yogurt.
Yeah, no blueberries in this town.
Anyway, he said, while the usual situations and leftovers are tense and drenched in panic, the dialogue for the most part reflects that. During this episode, all that is so distracting, I actually found myself hating all these people.
Huh.
Before, I thought they'd been through a lot and are forever changed by their events. It feels like the disappearing of millions did little to their actual personalities, since according to this episode, they've always been these horrible people. In retrospect, the aggressive dialogue found throughout the season of The Leftovers isn't a byproduct of circumstance, but rather bad writing. Adversely, the disappearing of these people only really changed one person, Jill, who went from a terribly acted happy teen to Wednesday from the Addams Family.
Wait, how did it not change Lori?
Well, he's saying
how
that, like,
how did
not
change Patty?
These people were all, well, come on now. They were all cracked people.
How did it not change Kevin Sr.?
That's,
like, so many of these people are so fucking different.
And we haven't got to that. Kevin Sr. has made the biggest change because he's, and maybe we just don't know him well enough yet, but he seems genuinely happy, self-assured, confident, everything you want a chief of police to be.
Understands the world too, right?
Yeah. Like, we're like giving his son solid advice.
Yeah.
And
then he goes to complete butt-naked lunatic.
There's no signs of cracks, unlike every other character we've gotten to know. Even Jill.
Yeah.
She was put on this happy act, but it seemed like it's intentional based on her and Tommy's conversation at the science fair, because she knows her parents are having problems, and she even thinks her dad's going to leave.
Yeah, I just imminently. Find it hard to say that these people have a problem. What they're struggling with is the idea of being human, right? Like, that's the episode spells it out. Like, you may not see a bigger purpose, but is that a problem? And people struggle with that. Everyone struggles with that. The idea of what is the purpose of being alive.
Sure. I want to speed things up because we still got some feedback to consider.
All right.
Jeff Inn wants to pry open the Lindelof debate again.
Okay.
He said, as a book reader, I'm very excited about where the show has gone. It's separated itself as I'd hoped to be its own story within the world it's created. This episode, again, had a very Lost-ish feel, but the finale of the show is something fans and Lindelof's were unhappy with. He's speaking of the Lost.
Sure.
Lindelof even said for him, said himself that for years he was unable to come to terms with the way he ended Lost. He's also said that he hopes for redemption with The Leftovers, but after seeing this episode, what does he think he needs redemption from? Does he feel he needs redemption because he was forced to keep that show going for far too many seasons, 121 episodes?
That's a lot.
Leading to too many unnecessary character stories and unanswered questions?
121 episodes is 12 seasons of this show.
No shit.
That's a lot of TV.
And that's one thing, you know, we talked about before. That's
they talked
one of the
about
best
to keep
things.
Walking Dead to 12 seasons. Like, they're hoping, oh, it'll go 12 seasons. That's a lot of shit.
Yeah, do you? Was it that after season one, viewers guessed a correct ending and he went on record saying it wasn't true when it actually was? Or was it something else completely? Let's face it, it's a show that was focused around a mystery and someone who is bound to figure it out at some point. So I ask you, Bald Move, what does he view as redemption and how will he succeed?
That's a good question.
I think his biggest problem was promising a lot of answers. And maybe that's right. Maybe there were people... No, I'm almost sure the people said that this is purgatory. And he said, nope, there is, that's not a valid answer. And it turns out it was purgatory.
The thing is, it's not really purgatory. It's like a...
I'm not... This is stuff we've already debated. So all it, those things like a, are...
aforementioned location that they will all meet in the afterlife. It's not actually purgatory. It's something else, but...
I think this is one of the reasons the material spoke to Lindelof, because this is a man who for years after Lost ended was subjected to hundreds if not thousands of irate emails of people on Twitter saying vile, terrible things about himself, about his lifestyle, about his friends and family. Sure. To the point that they ran him off the internet. Think about that. They ran a wealthy, powerful man, white man, off of the internet.
That's the power of the internet.
That, and you start thinking like Lori and the guilty remnant and people withdrawing from society and people's guilt. And I'm telling you, I wonder if some of those themes didn't speak to him because of his experience. That this that lost experience, even though it was on the whole very rewarding professionally and financially for him,
sure,
was kind of like this personal apocalypse, this creative apocalypse that he created himself.
I'm sure it could be. I mean, above all else, people are people, right? Regardless of how rich and famous you are.
Certainly.
And I mean, I'm sure, you know, he's got some money. Cuse has some money from Lost, but that doesn't change your fundamental humanity.
No, I mean, we don't get a lot.
You still question yourself. You still wonder.
Certainly.
All the things that everybody else who doesn't have money and success and fame.
No, yeah, no. And I'm far. I know for a fact I'm far more fragile than he. Like, you know.
Yeah, I would be off the internet day two.
Yeah, like the 50th direct message in a row, they're like, you're a fucking idiot. Yeah, I hate you. You ruined my life. I want 7 years of my life back. I'd be, nope, gone. Nathan P. said, I have a deer theory. The places where the deer was trapped can easily be connected to people that vanished. First, a school with Nora's kids, then a home, more specifically the room of Charlie, where we originally saw his parents and older couple talking about him in episode 2 to get the departure money from Nora. Deer hit by a car, the woman driving the car then vanishes. The balloon that was caught on it said, it's a girl. This could also be linked to Lori's pregnancy. An overarching idea is to think about the deer symbolizes a test. Kevin was given the task of trying to save the deer instead of kill it. Despite his efforts, he ends up having to shoot it anyway. As a punishment, people disappear. This could represent humanity as a whole being given some sort of test, but this creates even more questions to be answered. I just want to caution you, Nathan, that trying to unravel a mystery that Damon Lindelof himself,
you asshole,
has said is going to be unsolvable might make you turn Patty before this is over. And he's, again, if Lindelof is saying there ain't nothing there, you should sit up and take notice.
For sure.
In fact, I would like to know from people whether they are still interested in entertaining theories along those lines.
About the
disappearance.
The itself?
Because we were talking about this pre-show.
Yeah, no, that's a good question.
It's hard because, you know, telling our brains not to find patterns in something that has no pattern, but we have a bunch of data points, is like trying to throw your pet dog a piece of raw meat and telling him not to go for it.
Yeah.
So I'm content to read them, but I have the same response. Like, it sounds good, but I could also think of two or three things to discount these theories too. Like, for example, what test involved a convicted murderer in prison? You know,
I don't know.
Was the warden, you know, secretly wanted him to die this whole time, and he's like mad about him taking up a space, and like, I, you know, it's like, we'll never know that. All we can possibly know is this small.
Sure, and it comes down to like the theories that people are having about like, oh, these people all disappeared because someone wished them away. Well, what about the kids at the science fair? Mm-hmm. Like, there's so many things that you would just have to add explanations to out of whole cloth that. Yeah, none of it.
And again, the show creator is saying, we're not going to answer these.
Yeah.
So
that's not obviously not the point.
Yeah. let's go on and go to TK's take from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey guys, watching last night's episode and I have a theory about the Departed. I think the people who disappeared were at some time either prayed or wished that they were gone by someone close to them.
Didn't we just shoot down all theories related to why the Departed departed?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm just trying to give credit to first person that came forward with this particular theory.
Sure.
Another thing I noticed was the last couple episodes is when Kevin had a dream with the dog in a mailbox. Dean had dead, guilty remnant in his truck bed with plastic on their heads, just like he tried to kill Patty. Not sure if that means anything. So is the dog in a mailbox and the fact that he stashed cigarettes there and the fact that, you know, we talked about, is it significant? Oh, we don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. I just don't know. I just don't know with this show.
Mark D said, after watching episode 9, I think I figured out and presume the majority to figure it out a thread amongst those who have departed.
Okay.
This again, it's like in another one that said, there must be something else unique in this email about the people that are praying or wishing that their problems would go away for that second, the mother that had a screaming baby, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he says, I know that they will probably never tell us the exact reason of the departure, but I truly believe this theory is pretty close to being true. So it's like, what is, I'm wondering to Mark D and TK from St. Paul, Minnesota, and Nathan P, if you are propounding theories that you know will never be proven one way or another,
what are you expecting to happen?
What is our end game here? And I'm asking this as a genuine question because this is shaping our podcast, right? And we could go in more in depth of this and try to figure it out despite Lindelof.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lindelof can try to fuck us.
Yep.
And then we can say, how dare you, Lindelof? do we just make it a rule that we don't talk about this stuff? Or is it interesting to people? I
feel like enough people are talking about it that it's worthy of some discussion. Even though we know we're not going to get those answers.
It's not offensive to me is what I'm saying.
No.
But I just wonder if it's, we're undergoing our own little Don Quixote windmill tilting expedition. In fact, I feel like I know for a fact we're doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, we are. We are.
So it's like, you know, if someone had a theory about why Walter White's father named him Walter, it could be a very well argued with extensive sites and stuff, but we'll never know the answer to that. There.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
So that's all the feedback we have. If you'd like to send us some feedback, especially any speculation on what's going to happen for not next week, but the week after Memorial Day weekend's episode, let us know because we're going to have that special 15 to 20 minutes type of preview that we're doing for HBO. Send that in to leftovers@baldmove.com or on baldmove.com. Or Facebook.com/BaldMove or Twitter @BaldMove. And super excited to see you next week and the week after that for
finale, man.
Baby.
I wonder what they're going to do.
How many answers will be answered? How many questions will be raised? How many people will die? I feel like someone's going to die.
Everyone.
That's going to be my official prediction for the podcast.
They're all dead already. It doesn't matter.
they're going to wake up on Lost Island at the end of the series. That's where all the Departed go to.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. See you next Tuesday, I think. And until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.